Good afternoon. Again, I'll introduce myself for those of you who may be new with us this afternoon and weren't here yesterday morning. My name is John O'Neill. I'm a Lutheran staff chaplain at the Washington Correction Center in Shelton, Washington. Just a quick repeat of some of my background, just very briefly, so I don't get redundant, so that some of you know where I'm coming from. I am an ex-offender. I serve time, and I'm one of the ones of which I think there's many that we don't hear about who have turned their life around and done something with it. And I praise my Father for that and for some of the things I learned. I would like to emphasize again that I am not here to polarize. I don't want to polarize this group in any stretch of the imagination. I don't want to get a discussion started on who's right and who's wrong, because I don't think there's any good answers to that. I was very had to agree with our friend Judge Stoker here from Clark County. I assume it's Clark County, is that right, Fred? When he pointed out to me, too often we get into the dynamic of pointing the finger at the criminal justice system and the people in it more than we do sometimes of looking at the cause and what do we do about that. And that's really important, because we do have to look at the cause. And I'm not sure I have any good answers for the cause. I think for me, the probably the most important that I can think of from experience in dealing with inmates and their families, and the inmates' childhood and background, is the complete breakdown of the family unit. To me, that has a priority. I think if we could do something about that, and believe me, I have no answers for that. I don't know how to start doing something with that, other than through the churches, which I feel is the only real, strong, firm approach to the problem that we have with our prison population. I have had the opportunity to deal with the backgrounds of most of a large percent of the inmates that I deal with. And part of my, interesting enough, which is not allowed anymore, but when I was an inmate, I had a job that dealt with the incoming records of every new inmate coming into our reception center at Shelton, Washington. And by and large, every one of them came from a broken family, or a family who was so wrapped up in, quotes, making a living to give my children what I didn't have, that they lost sight of what that child needed. Basically, love and concern. And it really didn't make any difference whether that child had a shoebox that he made into a car to play with, or a big fancy toy. We didn't get too many of the affluent, but occasionally we did. Also, out of that came from that background, quite often one or more parents were either in prison or had served time. One or more parents was either an alcoholic, or both were alcoholics. So the upshot of it was they had a pretty miserable childhood. Also, another large factor is child abuse. And it's only right now, in the last few years, is it coming out of the closet. Some of our new laws have allowed people to report the conditions going on in homes of children and not have to fear reprisal because of it's no longer necessary for them to be present. It's just they can report the incident, and then as the Child Protective Service then takes over in this state. Generally, all my remarks are related to the state of Washington because that's the only one I can speak on with some expertise.
It's true in Oregon too. You can file an anonymous
complaint. Yeah. I'm sure more. I think more and more states are doing this now, just in order to bring this problem out, because it's amazing the fantastic amount of child abuse that goes on. By and large, most of our inmates have been abused in one way or another, sexually, physically, or emotionally.
You mean in the home itself where they came from?
In the home where they came from, that's correct, sir. Not always by the parent, sometimes by close friends. It's just amazing. People that you know well who have abused a child in that home, a friend. I don't have any answers for that either, but that's what's going on. So with all this background of problems that these people stem from, I cease to be amazed that there aren't more in the institutions. Also, I think I may have mentioned yesterday, if I didn't, I want to do it today, that I feel that our criminal justice system, where it, granted it has problems, and it there's some things that need being redone, but by and large, I think they do a pretty darn good job that they have been mandated by society to accomplish, taking into consideration what they have to deal with. Continually changing laws of constitutional rights and some things that we just don't understand that make it very difficult. I think sometimes we manage to swing the pendulum in our country, whatever the problem is, all the way one way and then all the way the other way, and finally we get it maybe back to somewhat to a balance. I'm not always sure about that either. So with that, a little bit of background or where I'm coming from with this, I want to go into some a little bit of theological rationale. I'd like to do my presentation, and then I will open it up for some questions and so forth and do my best to answer them. I have with me here it's called Justification by Faith in the Prison System. And this is the Commission on Theology of the National Alliance of French Lutheran Churches was asked in 1971 to carry out a study of justification by faith and its present day social implications, particularly in regard to the problems of freedom and imprisonment. The commission was greatly assisted by the contributions from Jean-Jacques Felice, Alexander Keyes, and Eric Haramore, jurists attached to the Council of Europe in Strasbourg, and by prison chaplains Tonia Metzel and Henry Aschenbein. The final report of the commission, which follows, was published in 1973. It was deliberately kept brief so as to make it more useful to Lutheran congregations and others interested in prisoners' problems. I also want to stress at this point, sometimes I overlook it, it's in my head, but I sometimes overlook it, that I am not only concerned about the prison population or the inmate per se, I'm also concerned about the victims, because they're really synonymous. We get to talking a lot about prison reform and a lot about how do we help the prisoner and yep. But what do we do for the victim? They're just as much involved. And they're also suffering and paying a penalty. In addition to those two segments of the society, the families, the wives, the children, some cases husbands, mothers, fathers of the inmates are suffering. I believe the statistic says that for every inmate in the state of Washington sentenced to the Department of Corrections, adult corrections, that person also touches seven other people outside. So when you realize prison population that we have, we're talking about a lot of people. The preaching of justification by faith is relevant not only to the lives of individuals, but also to that of society. It is particularly relevant when we are faced with a problem of delinquents, both at the time of their imprisonment and when they are released. Because God is both justice and love, and his invitation of salvation is given to all and without conditions. The first man who heard Jesus say that he would meet him in paradise was a criminal who had been condemned to death. The preaching of justification by faith excludes all forms of self-justification, such as that of the decent type, who feels that the claims of the society to which he belongs gives him the right to inflict imprisonment or even vengeance. That of the prisoner who likes to bring forward his personal systems of justification, which may range from minimizing his own offense to nihilism, and who may also claim that the initial fault lies with society. And that's something we hear day in and day out. Hey, I don't got a problem. It's society's problem. They put me here. Well, to some extent, maybe that's true. But by and large, and it is the inmate's fault. And I have no problem setting that man down and say, hey, man, who did it? Oh, I did it. Okay. What are we arguing about? Now, it's time that you face the reality and take responsibility for your actions. And that's where I come from when I'm working with counseling with inmates. I just want you to understand that for me, there is no question of coddling. Fairness, honesty, I think is important. These two attitudes are based on a judgment of the deserving and undeserving values of certain acts, which are seen to be good or bad. According to this view, when one has committed an offense, there is a price to pay. But once this is paid, the account is settled. This way of reasoning is not only much too simplistic and superficial, but it also obviously contrary to the gospel of justification by the grace of God. It is clearly hypocritical to divide humanity into two groups, the just and the unjust, those who have not transgressed the law and those who have, the free and the imprisoned. Such a division is contrary to the findings of criminological research, which show that the majority of criminals, quotes, are neither prosecuted nor given a police record. It is also contrary to the divine law, which is related to a person's inner attitude and conscience rather than his outward behavior. Now, there's quite a bit more to that, but that's the basic things I wanted to bring out there. Granted, on the surface, you can say, well, that's idealistic, and to some extent it is. This is a paper I presented at a seminar here not too long ago, which deals with somewhat of the same thing, basically from where we're coming from in the Lutheran Church, where in a lot of my contacts with Bishop Lundy and other Lutheran chaplains involved in chaplaincy, in the prison chaplaincy. The church and Christian people have a legitimate interest in the jails and prisons of this state and the men and women incarcerated in them. This interest flows from a biblical tradition which presents to us a God of justice whose overriding concerns are love and the health of the whole human family. The call to seek after justice in the human community is rooted in this understanding of God. Such justice has two sides. On the one hand, each person is accountable for his or her individual acts, which injure other persons or society. On the other hand, all offenders should be treated as children of God. Within this framework, biblical justice is concerned with the real effect upon people. Any damage done must be repaired. All parties must be reconciled, and relationships in the community must be restored. A popular equation of justice with simple retaliation is based on the concept of an eye for an eye. However, within the historical context of this biblical language, this was not a divine endorsement of unlimited retaliation against an offender. Rather, it was a restriction set upon human vengeance in order to avoid an escalating spiral of violence. Its purpose was to ensure that some proportionality was maintained between crime and punishment. Jesus, who appears in history as the incarnate Word of God, demonstrates what is to be our spirit toward one another at all times and in all places. This spirit is captured in his acts of forgiveness, healing, compassion, and reconciliation. Christians are called to duplicate these acts in relationships with all persons. In the case of prisoners, the call is issued to Christian persons by two biblical texts. One is the admonition of the letter to the Hebrews, "Remember those who are in prison as though you were in prison with them." Another is the painful vision of the final judgment. The king will say to the people, "On his right, you are blessed. I was in prison and you visited me." And the righteous will say, When did we see you in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer back, "Whenever you did this for one of the least important of these ones of mine, you did it for me." Moreover, Christian people know that they, with all humankind, stand under judgment. Etched in their awareness is the teaching of Jesus, "Whichever one of you has committed no sin may throw the first stone." Again we are taught, "All have sinned and are far away from God's saving presence." But by the free gift of God's grace, they are all but put right with Him through Jesus Christ, who sets them free. The Church teaches that the gracious mercy of God extends to publicans and sinners, to the weak and the poor, to the erring and the hopeless. The grace that is the hope of these persons is the same grace that is our deliverance. These beliefs stand as a foundation for the concern of the Church and Christian persons for jails and prisons and the men and women incarcerated in them. How do we balance that with what's going on? I don't know if any of you here have been had any personal contact with robbed or something, member of your family injured or whatever. But it's pretty difficult to accept that as it's written and go that route. I'm not saying that that's an easy thing to do. I struggle every day with the men I deal with. I get involved in some really gross histories of criminal acts. And I guess for me, the way I deal with it is that Friend, I don't have to judge you. I'm not here to judge you. That's between you and your God. I hope to help you find him.
Sir, what age bracket would you say that most of these men that you deal with fit into?
The group that I'm dealing with run anywhere from about the youngest now is 15, and I think our oldest inmate is 72. We run a wide swath of people, age brackets. It becomes difficult to rationalize and deal with this. These things. I have only had one man that I dealt with that I finally had to say, hey, I can't work with this man any longer. I turn him over to another chaplain. And we have to do that, and that's okay. That's okay. No, that doesn't say I can't handle it, or I'm not, or that I'm something wrong with me, or whatever. It was just a case I could not handle. Because of a man and his wife who killed a 16-year-old daughter, I think it was. They starved her to death and beat her every day. Children get involved, I have problems. So in this case, I backed off and gave it to another chaplain to handle the work with. We don't often know the end result of the work we do. We try to place that person in God's hands and pray that he will hear the word. We cannot change anybody. That person must change themselves. Hopefully we will give them the tools to work at changing themselves. And that has to be done with counseling, with forms of self-investigation, starting to deal with the person's image, who self-image who may have been pretty well blasted out from the time he was 3 years old or 4 years old or 5 years old or whatever. Whatever he came from. Well, it makes it very difficult when you're dealing with this type of work. But the thing that we have to get them to understand is, for us, for where I come from, and with more or less our philosophy in our department at Shelton, is to make this person, first of all, start to accept that what he's done is wrong. Make him realize, or to help him realize, we can't make him, to help him realize that he's got to deal with that problem and to learn to take responsibility for his actions. And this is a long-term process, and it's difficult. And I don't know. He asked me, if anybody asked me the percent of success, I don't have any answer for that. We never hear about the ones that make it. Very, very seldom do we ever hear about the ones that make it. We more often hear about the ones that don't make it, because they usually get back in the headlines again, one way or another. One of the problems that we have, where the church fits in, where society fits in. When a man goes out on parole, most people do not realize, and even that individual generally does not realize, the traumatic effect this is going to have on him. Because some of these guys have been in from 1 to 5 years or even longer. A life sentence is 13-4 in the state of Washington before he can even start dealing with the parole board to any extent. And you can imagine, if you were away from what's happened in the last 10 years in our economy, or any segment of that, 3, 5, 7 years of that, not having any real touch with it because you've been housed, you've been fed, you've been clothed, you know, you hadn't had to worry about it. All of a sudden, you're back out in society where you've got to support yourself. Can you imagine what that would feel like? All of a sudden, gas went from, what, 35 cents a gallon to a dollar and a half a gallon. Groceries, my wife went to the store the other day just before we came, before I came up to Holden here, and she opened up the back of the station wagon. She says, there's $84 worth of groceries. It was 3 sacks, you know, the larger sacks. But I could carry 2 of them without any struggle. So they've got to get back, some of them with families. They've got to get back out and deal with this. They're scared. I know, I went through this. I know what it is. But for the grace of God, I could have ridden right back in again. Because it's a scary, scary thing. Because you do not realize what's been taken away from you. Your self-confidence, for one thing. It generally is gone. I was a pretty strong person when I went in, and I felt that I could deal with my problem and handle it when I got out. And I found out, no way, not by myself. It was not that easy. So that's something we have to think about. That's some of the reasons I feel cause the return rate, part of the cause, small part of it, but part of it. They get out and then they start looking for work. If they don't have a job lined up, or they've been in work release maybe and haven't been able to find a job or whatever, and they get rejected. There aren't very many of us who can stand to be rejected too long, and something's going to happen. We have to be wanted. We have to be needed. And we have to be loved. And it ain't easy to love some of these guys without the grace of God. I could not. But after a while, with continual rejection, they're going to just give up. Say, hey, I blew it. And they said if I went to prison and paid my price that I would... paid for my crime, my sin, that it's forgiven, and I can resume my life. That's not true. In most cases, that is not true. Because we, you and I, and our brothers and sisters, don't allow that to happen. Once a man has been in prison, we say, oh, there's something, you know, he's different. He's wrong. And he probably was wrong, what he did. But we don't allow him ever to forget that. And let me underline one thing. If you've once been through the prison system and you've done something wrong, you don't forget it. Nobody has to tell you. You do not forget it. You have to learn to deal with that. You've got to learn how to deal with it in a healthy manner. Not deny it, not block it, but allow it to be part of your history that you realize is there so that you don't allow yourself to get into that situation again, whatever it may be, whatever caused it. But we do not allow these men a chance. Now, granted, a lot of people have reached out. I've reached out myself, and I've been burnt more than once. And I'll probably be burnt again, because I'll continue to reach out. I set a young man up who had done over 7 years. He had a second-degree murder conviction. He
He'd been up at Walla Walla. He'd witnessed a murder there. He'd been raped. And they were moving him around in protective custody and so forth to try and keep him out of much any more harassment. Finally, he got a chance to go on work release. He went up to Clallam County Jail in Port Angeles to cook up there. Now, here was a young man who in his time finished his high school, got an Associate of Arts degree in two different fields, one in food management and I think business was the other, AA in business. Basically, had made pretty good use of his time. I contacted the Lutheran Church in that community and through the pastor, and we set up, to make a long story short, we set him up pretty well. Got him some work so that he would have work when he got through with his work release program. The district attorney and the mayor of Port Angeles even wrote letters of recommendation to the parole board hoping to cut some of his time. What I'm saying is everything was going for him. And we all felt that, hey, this guy's going to make it. Had him down at my house on furlough. Gave him money to deal with, to help him. With less than 2 months to go, he split. And, you know, all he had to do was pick up the phone and call the pastor, and Bob would have been right there to help him. He knew very well he could call me long distance collect and I would accept the charges. He knew that. And he split. I don't have any answer for that. He went out. He went to Tennessee. He went out of state. He went to New Orleans. Got himself a good job. Stayed out of trouble. Didn't get any trouble. Went up to Tennessee to see his children. He was in the store, and policeman in the vicinity who knew him from years gone by said, what's he doing out? Ran a radio check on him, and they didn't have a hold on him or a want on him in Tennessee, but the NCIC had a want on him, so I picked him up. He's back in the institution awaiting whatever's going to happen now, and I spent some time talking to him, trying to find out, hey, Tommy, what happened? Where did we go wrong? What did we do wrong? And why? Some of the things I came up with were fear. Fear that you can taste. Granted, there were some problems in the work release program that he was in that I feel very strongly the man who is involved in that should not be there, but that still is not any excuse for blowing your life. I asked Tommy, I said, well, you know, maybe we did too much, and we can do too much. We can place too many expectations on him, and I kind of feel that maybe part of that was the cause for that particular case, that we expected too much of Tommy. And I blame myself for that a little bit. I don't carry a guilt load. I don't mean that. But I do feel that maybe with just too much, we expected him to do too much too fast, and this scared him. And probably for most of us, that doesn't scare us too much. But for a man who's been locked up for a long period of time, It's pretty devastating. We're going to have failures. No question about that.
Was this person married and had children?
He had been married. Had children in Tennessee, yet not locally. His wife, they were divorced, but he went back to see his children. those are some of the things that we wonder when we reach out. We have to understand that we're going to have failures, that everybody isn't going to make it. And I think we get into the dynamic of feeling that, hey, we're going to save all these people. And I don't know where we come from with that one, because Jesus couldn't do it, and I don't know how we feel we can do it. But sometimes we get into that one. And that's not where we need to be. I think where we need to be is to become acquainted, educated in our system. What our criminal justice system is all about. How it functions. How it handles its problems and its situations. By and large, the criminal justice system is going to do what you tell them to do. You're the ones that pay the bill. And they listen to the pulse of the public. And the public makes a lot of decisions based on lack of knowledge. I'm not saying that everybody makes these decisions from a standpoint of retribution. But as I said yesterday, we are punishment-minded as opposed to rehabilitation-minded. So the courts and the system functions in that context. Basically what you, the taxpayer, says, what you vote for, what you advocate. One of the, for example, as all of you are aware, the state of Washington, and I guess other states too, have been going through a real budget crunch. Well, somewhere between 70 and 90% of all felonies in the state of Washington are drug and alcohol related. Now, part of cutting the budget was to do away in the state of Washington, in our institutions, with the drug and alcohol programs and counselors in every institution. For me, it doesn't make sense. Now, granted, it cut a lot of dollars out. It saved a lot of dollars, directly, I guess. But my point is, indirectly, I think it's going to cost you about three times as much, because a percentage of those people were going to get something and maybe get a handle on some of their problems and make it. So you wouldn't have them back in the system again, paying for them.
What percent?
I can't tell you that. I don't know.
If it was like 2%, it might not be worth a dollar.
Well,
80%
Well, I don't have any figures on that. I don't think anybody has some real figures on that.
Was there a strong feeling from those who made the cuts that they need the program to prove ineffective?
I can't answer that. I have no answer for that. All I know is that the program was doing a lot of good in our institution, and in talking to other areas, it was also helping. I'm not trying to sit here and say that any one program is going to solve the problem. It takes a number of different programs, of different things, in order to make even an inroad on the problem. But I don't say there's any simple answers or that I have the answers. My main reason for being here, as I said before, is education. The best of my ability to educate what is happening in our institutions here in the state of Washington. I have here a report by Eugene Doschel, who's director of the Information Center, National Council on Crime and Delinquency, rate and length of imprisonment. How does the United States compare with the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden? Quite an interesting, I'm not going to go through the whole thing. I'm just going to pick out some things here that have interest to you. In the conclusion, it says, few countries adhere to the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights as a matter of course. The Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden belong to this small group. Yet Swedes are not at all satisfied with their existing crime policy, and still more radical humanitarian changes are in the making. Criminal justice in Sweden, says Knut Severi, appears to be advanced only because conditions in most other countries are abominable. If a Dutch or Scandinavian visitor were to come to the United States to study our system of justice, what could he report to his home country? We're just using the state of Florida in this one. If he went to Florida, he would find a prison population rising incredibly fast. 11,420 inmates in January of 75, 15,709 January of 76, 17,632 July 30 of 76. He would observe that Florida judges are sending people to prisons at the rate of 100 a week. And that because of the overcrowding, there is a backlog of state inmates and county jails waiting to be admitted to state prisons, while at the other end, state prison inmates are being contracted out to county jails because the prisons no longer have the room to hold them. He would be told that a warehouse was holding 600 inmates and that the state had built a prison tent city to accept some of the overflow. He would discover that an additional 11,000 are in county jails, either awaiting trial or serving sentences, and over 1,000 Floridians are serving terms in federal prisons. Finally, he would discover that there are over 3,400 juveniles under commitment in juvenile correction and correctional institutions. If he were Dutch, he would note that Florida, with half the population of highly industrialized, urbanized, and overcrowded Holland, imprisons about 33,000 human beings, more than 16 times the number imprisoned in his own country. That, at this time, is what, in our own state, that's pretty typical, I think, of most any state in the Union. And it reverts back to the thing I said was first, which Judge Stoker mentioned, the cause. How do we get to that? Because somewhere we've got to bring something to a halt and start turning this thing around. And I don't sit here as any expert in how we're going to do that. Right now, in our own state, we're taking in 80 more than we're putting out. 80 more per month than we're turning loose. Which says that if you compute that all on out over a period of time, I think Amos Reed figured out that we'd be building a new 500-bed prison every 90 days. Which, of course, is impossible. Right now, the cost of per bed to build a new prison ranges from about $70,000 to $100,000 per bed. Now, that's just to build it. The facts and figures here that we're welcome to look at. That doesn't say anything about the maintenance. Plus the cost per inmate of an average of $20,000 per year to maintain that prisoner. Plus the cost of whatever social or benefits or whatever, welfare or whatever his family's on. Again, I'm not advocating that we open the prison's doors and turn them loose. Something we've got to think about. How can we utilize this money more effectively, more efficiently, to take care of, do something in turning around to reach the cause, to deal with the cause. And I don't know who is going to do it if it isn't us, our churches, whatever denomination they may be. Because I think that's where we have to reach. That's my reason for, I do a lot of traveling around the state talking to congregations and so forth on the same line.
How about schools? How much responsibility do you put on their shoulders?
On the schools?
Yes.
I don't put any responsibility one way, pro or con, with the schools. I don't like much of that system about it. As far as you are, I don't know what you're asking me, whether you're asking me how much responsibility they have for training the children, or I'm not sure. Well, they certainly have, the state schools have a responsibility, but here again, I think they're hampered by some of the same things that the criminal justice system or our prison system is hampered by, is funding prisons, or excuse me, the society. You know, we're all, I don't know, I think sometimes we get our priorities screwed up. I'm not just sure, you know, we're always talking about, every time we turn around there's a school levy and people get tired of that, and sometimes I've heard people say, well, my kids are grown now, I don't have to worry about that anymore, so I don't pay attention to the school budgets. I think that's wrong. I think that thinking is wrong. Sure, they have a responsibility, but I think we're back to the basic home family unit. I really don't know any place else to do it. I'll stop my particular presentation at this point and open it up for him. Yes.
I wanted to ask you a question. With your job, do the people have to come to you first, or do you go and introduce yourself to them? How does that work?
How do the inmates get to the chaplain?
Right.
Open your door in the morning and stand out, stand away.
Oh.
You don't have any problem.
And a lot come. That's what I was wondering. How receptive.
Well, yes. We you have to understand a little bit about the criminal, the prison code. Anybody that goes to see a chaplain is a weakling.
Well, that's what I was wondering.
So we wind up, by and large, with the homosexuals, the sex offenders, those who struggle with dealing in population, they can't deal, they have a hard time in population. Population means out with the whole, in the yard and so forth. The young kids that are scared green. Periodically, we get a good, strong con boss, and we look for them. Be very honest with you, we look for a good, strong con boss. I use them because they're neat people to have around. Because if you get one who's really trying to turn his life around, he's looked up to. And he comes to chapel, or he comes up to see the chaplain, and the rest of the guy, hey, that's not too bad. That guy goes, he's so-and-so. So they come up. We get a lot of them that way. We get a lot of referrals from pastors throughout the district. We get calls from home. We deal with marriage counseling, premarital counseling, deaths in the family. Just everything you can think of. Yeah.
And you know, they also say that crime is so high, and then you're talking about the men being raped and stuff. If someone comes to you and they're afraid and people are really hassling them, can you offer them any protection? I mean, if you were to go and talk to the guards or anything, do they pay much attention to?
Well, we don't have to do that.
Oh.
And the reason I say we don't have to do it, if we get wind of it, yeah, we know what to do. But oh. any inmate, if he is in fear of his life, can go to his hall officer or the sergeant in his hall and check in, which means he goes to protective custody. Now, that doesn't say that that's going to do it, but they try. But you know, there's no way that you can watch every crevice and corner in a prison and keep a guy from getting knifed or
raped. those 17, where was it, in Idaho, where the three 17-year-olds killed the other one. You know, it's really scary.
That's...
Yeah.
That's reality. That's right. Not a story. That's reality. Believe me, you had your hand up.
I think you've done an admirable job in the sketching for us the complexities of the problems. I wonder, I'd like to direct this question to you or anyone else here. Given that the problem is extremely complex and difficult to solve, do you have any list of suggestions for changes that can be made in the criminal justice system to improve the situation?
Yes.
Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, I have suggestions. In fact, I hope to wind that up on Friday with a list of those type of things to deal with. They're all merely suggestions. They're way, and they're not the final answer. I don't know who's got the answer. I certainly don't have it. I don't think that I know of anybody in the criminal justice system in any state has it. Other than if we could do something with a family unit, I think that's.
I have actually two questions. The first one is, do they work? And I mean, are they given something to do during the day? And my second question is there any one crime that is less likely to be a repeat, or most likely to be a repeat? Is there any one offender?
I'll answer the last one first.
Okay.
Our greatest percent of failures and repeat offenders are sex offenders, and there's a reason for that. Yes, they are given jobs or school. In our institution, we have a school program, high school, Garrett Hines High School, and we have vocational school program, and then we have kitchen, work in the kitchen, work in the laundry, work in maintenance, porters in the halls. They try to program, have everybody program, what we call program, do something to keep busy. Now, granted, our institution was built for 800, we're pushing 1,200. The legislature just recently removed the restrictions on Shelton that we can double bunk in all of our whole institution. They haven't been allowed to do that up until this last legislature. Now we're allowed to double bunk. Now we've done that in one hall, and it's a zoo. But we can't keep them all busy. They try. Yes.
Do you know what they do with the Mexicans? Now I live.
Chicanos.
I live in Yakima, where we have the fruit workers.
I hear
and
you.
And we have murder after murder after murder, and they're all Mexicans. What are we doing with them? Are we sending them back to old Mexico, or does the United States have to take their aliens? They aren't even citizens.
They must be, because we're not getting them. We get a few, and of the Mexicans, but they aren't. But the ones that I've been dealing with primarily, that I'm aware of anyway, are not violent type crimes. I mean, there's some assaults and that type of thing, but not a viciously violent type crime. Most of, I'm aware of what goes on in Yakima. Chelan County, they got them right here. But I don't know what, apparently they're sending them back to Mexico, unless they're a citizen, you know. So I haven't seen too many of them. Yes?
Did Charles Colson or any of the graduates of his classes have converted prisoners visit your prison?
Visit our prison? Yes, we've had a prison fellowship group there. We had one 2 years ago, I think it was, and we had one last June. Had a five-day Bible study and interaction. It went on day, and that is throughout the day and into the evening. We did that for 5 days.
Do you feel that Colson's conversion is genuine?
Yeah, I have no reason not to believe it. I think it is. I've heard him speak. I've met him personally and talked to him. I have no reason, you know. Yeah, I've read both of them. Right. Yeah, I think it's genuine. Yes.
Do You mentioned the family unit, and I agree with you that that certainly is, it would appear to be the strongest human group to be able, if that was strong, we'd probably see less people going awry in society. But given that, in the very, very high return rate of convicts, and all the discussion with balancing the punitive aspects of the justice system with the humanitarian, is there really any sense in moving more towards the humanitarian, considering that the guys that are in there have already blown it from a family standpoint, or somebody's blown it for them?
Not necessarily.
And there's a very high rate of return anyway. Do you just stick them in there and leave it the way it is, or you try to improve that system?
Well, my feeling is that we should try to improve the system. I don't think you can take, it's where do you stop and where do you start? Because it's a vicious cycle. And as the cycle goes around, it picks up new converts all the time. So it gets getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Somewhere we've got to bring it to a halt and start turning some of it around. I don't think that we can just take what we've got and leave them there and not do something. I think in our prisons, our programming, I think we need to give these people tools to work with to change their self-image, to help them understand some of the reasons that they're doing what they're doing or their behavioral pattern. I don't think that we can accomplish anything by locking people up for long periods of time and do nothing, basically nothing for them. It's kind of like a wheat farmer over here in Chelan County or Douglas County or back in the Midwest. You buy them a huge farm and just a real nice farm to work with and just really neat, but you don't give them any tools. It's going to die. And that's kind of what we're doing in the prisons. We don't have any counseling, one-on-one, group type things. There are some. But we're not getting to in the prisons themselves, we're just not getting to these guys to deal with them. And I'm not saying that we're going to be able to reach everyone. Don't misunderstand me. But everyone we reach and turns his life around, as one less is going to be back paying the bill for.
Thank you.